A Fire in the Heavens, the first draft.
Caton was awake before the sailor knocked on the door to her cabin. She had slept poorly since they had left Marth, and tonight the sway of her hammock mixed with uneasy dreams. Her heart sped. Had the crew finally decided to mutiny? No, a mutiny would not begin with a knock. She sent a prayer to the Seven Sisters to grant her calm.
Enter!
Caton swung her legs over the side of her hammock and set her bare feet on the smooth wood floor. She had removed her leg wraps to sleep, letting the loose fabric of her leggings puddle on the bridges of her feet. In the deep night, the light of the sailor's glow disc cast swaying shadows against the tiny space.
Pardon, Mother. The captain says we're inside the land.
Praise the sisters.
Months at sea, and they finally had land in sight. She picked up her own glow disc and flipped the cover back to expose the phosphorescent surface. Ashore, a disc would fade to darkness during the course of a night, but the constant motion of the ship agitated the power trapped within and kept them always glowing at least dimly. She shook hers to brighten it further. With its light, she took a moment to bind her scarf of office around her neck before following the sailor above decks. Caton looked up for the cluster of stars that the Seven Sisters inhabited in the heavens.
Thank you, sisters, for guiding our search this far.
The captain turned as she approached. Stillian's tall form swayed easily with the rocking of the ship.
Well, you were right.
Caton did not take the triumph that he offered her, tempting though it was. Stillian had mocked her goals, but taken the church's commission nonetheless. His acknowledgement that she had been right could be counted a victory, but it did not belong to her. The triumph lay with the sisters. She was too grateful that he had been willing to sail on a course other captains considered foolhardy, following the trail of ancient stories about a land far to the west. She looked past him to the horizon. A glow lay on the horizon, marking the division of the world from the sky with its light. The sea retained its dark mystery while the sky brightened as though dawn were approaching, but the sun would rise behind them. Caton closed her glow disc, tucking it into the pocket inside her left sleeve so that it did not interfere with her night vision. She frowned, slowly understanding what the glow meant.
I don't know why I expected the land to be uninhabited.
It must have a massive city ahead to cast so much light.
The sisters have prepared a way for us.
Caton's people had suffered enough persecution for their beliefs back in Marth. Old stories told that the Seven Sisters had been blown away by a storm from Selen, a homeland far to the west. They now lived in the heavens to watch over their children. Passed down from mother to daughter, the beliefs had eroded over the centuries spent in Marth among the worship of the sun. The corruption and greed in Marth had finally led the Sisters' Sayer to fund this expedition to find the way back to Selen.
To be honest, I wasn't sure how long I would be able to keep the crew sailing west, but we were going to go right off the edge, they did.
Stillian bent his head back to look at the sky.
Perhaps we'll see the moon, too.
That's an exaggerated superstition.
And tales of a land aren't?
Modern scholars feel that our holy texts are guides for ways to live a better life. They are allegories, and yet...
Caton tucked her hands inside her sleeves, crossing her arms over her chest as though she were lecturing at the seminary.
There is always some basis for the tales. A land, even if it is not a new continent, must be at minimum an island. This moon, we believe that it is a corruption of the word moaned, which means city or town in Old Frisian. So we think that it refers to the city the Seven Sisters came from. And the light of Moaned lay behind them, casting silver across the sea. This refers to the wealth and knowledge of the homeland, as does the passage, which refers to Moaned as the brightest light in the darkness.
Not much point in arguing with you about your own religion.
It does seem unprofitable.
To her surprise, Stillian gave her a crooked smile. They said nothing else, but watched the distant glow grow nearer. All the while the wind played around her, lifting her seven braids and tickling her with the ends. No one seemed inclined to go to bed as they raced across the ocean toward landfall. The light from the city was like nothing she had seen before. It was cool and silvery, as though a glow disc were reflecting in a polished metal mirror. It grew brighter by the minute.
Captain!
In the crow's nest, a sailor pointed to the horizon. When she looked back to where he pointed, Caton's heart seized. A low mound of light had emerged above the horizon. It was not the glow of city lights, but a single broad arc that glowed with an unearthly light. She tried to make sense of the size, but could not grasp the distances.
How big is that?
I am not certain. Pardon.
With a half bow, he made his way to the foot of the mainmast.
Ahoy, the crow's nest! Give me the measurements!
The wind blew the response away from her, but the answer caused the captain to turn abruptly and stare at the horizon. He pressed his hand to his mouth, and his eyes were wide with something that, on another man, Caton would name terror. She crossed the deck to where the captain stood.
What is the matter?
It's the measurements. It cannot be correct.
Oh, surely you can't tell from so far.
But we can. When we see another ship upon the horizon or land, we need to be able to calculate how large it is and how far away. This is vast.
The glowing edge of the disc pulled her gaze once more. Enough of it was visible now to draw shadows from the rails. Long, crisp shadows as though a dimmer sun were rising. The light lay before them and cast silver across the sea. Water splashed on Caton's skin as she went through the seven postures of the morning meditation in the bow of the ship. Meditation did not come easily today. As she balanced on one foot, in Doro's stance, she watched the sky. The sun had risen as it always did. On the horizon, the mound grew larger but seemed no closer. It was fainter during the day, but just as visible. She had not gone to bed, nor had most of the crew. Those not on duty watched as she did, seemingly transfixed by the way the light had grown to a half-sphere. When more of it had become visible over the horizon, it became clear that it was not land, but some vast disk. It was impossible to grasp the size of it. A dinner plate held out at arm's length would just cover it, but a dinner plate would not be visible past the curve of the world. Perhaps it was a beacon or a source to light their land at night. The base of it should be visible soon. Caton leaned out as though that would help her see the support sooner. It too must be impossibly large. The disk cleared the horizon. Caton squinted against the haze and set her foot down, breaking the sequence. She could not see a base. She stepped to the rail as the ship skipped over the waves in front of a brisk wind. Her braids beat against her cheeks as she waited. The orb seemed to rise higher, but nothing held it. A sailor touched his fingers from his mouth to his forehead in a warning gesture.
There's no land after all.
No, there's only that thing, and it's unnatural.
Well, it's past time we turn back.
Agreed. Captain needs to quit taking orders from the Night Lover.
No.
Caton pushed herself back from the rail. She shaded her eyes against the sun and looked for the captain. He stood on the nautical term, speaking with the navigator and the first mate. Their heads were close together in tight conversation. Caton tucked her hands into her sleeves and hurried across the deck. The navigator lifted her head and scowled openly.
Don't you go spouting some hokum about this being a sign.
Porritt jabbed her finger at the orb.
That thing is unnatural.
But not unexpected. You may not believe in the Seven Sisters, but you must acknowledge that the stories speak of this.
Occult nonsense. The fact that someone sailed this far and saw that thing does not mean that land is in front of us.
Porritt crossed her arms under her breasts and glared at the captain and first mate. Caton turned from the navigator to face Captain Stillian.
We hired you to sail west. Thus far, all of the indications prove that our texts are correct. The land of Selin is ahead of us. Is there a reason beyond your navigator's fear to turn back?
It's common sense, not fear.
Peace.
The captain held up his hand between them and turned to Caton.
Your religious texts are allegories, you said. Has it occurred to you that your sisters may have sailed to this point from somewhere else and then turned back?
Caton's gaze slipped to the orb hanging in the sky. What else could this be but the moon? Caton met the captain's gaze as though he were a congregation of one.
Old Frisian is not related to any other language. Where did it come from, if not the West?
You paid us to sail for 4 fifth nights, and so we shall. You have until the 8th of Reed, but not a day past that.
There will be land.
The moon rose higher as they sailed farther west. Caton chewed her lower lip, watching the pale object. Its shape varied through the course of the day, from a bow-like crescent, it swelled to a shining disk, then gradually diminished again to just an arc of light. The cycle repeated with slow regularity, but the moon never vanished entirely. It had risen high enough over the past week that it had come close to the Seven Sisters' path across the heavens. With the hour approaching midnight, it was now swollen to nearly a full disk. Other stars had dimmed and disappeared behind it, then reappeared on the other side. Would the sisters yield their place as well? Caton tugged at her scarf of office, which seemed too tightly tied tonight. She had trouble breathing as she watched the sky. The sisters' stately progress carried them to the moon. They dimmed as they approached it. They vanished. Caton sank to her knees. She had guessed they would, and yet, it was the night sky without the sisters to watch over them. They had to come back out on the other side.
Are you all right?
Yes, thank you. I was just watching that.
Caton could not voice the disappearance of the sisters to him.
Perhaps you should not. I think it may drive men mad to contemplate it. We are not prepared for something so vast.
But at some point, my people did know it.
Caton pressed her fingers to her temples, trying to soothe the pressure building there.
But it is one thing to believe, or to disbelieve. It is quite another to see the proof of one's convictions floating in the sky.
She lifted her head. Was he speaking of her, or himself?
Ship ahead!
The captain scrambled to his feet and dashed to the nautical term. Caton completely forgotten. She climbed to her feet, scanning the horizon for what the lookout had seen. On the sea, backlit by the light of the orb, floated the unmistakable silhouette of a sailing ship. And a ship sailing toward them could only mean that there was land ahead.
Lower the sails!
The sailors complied, and gradually the ship slowed in the water.
What is the matter?
They're running dark, no lights. Either it's a pirate ship or everyone is dead. Either way, we'll wait until daylight to approach.
Once the dawn came, it took several hours for them to meet the other ship. Its rigging was strange, even to Caton's untrained eye. It rode very low in the water and had a beaked bow which curved in the air like a swan's neck. It was clear by the light of day that the ship was inhabited, but they made no hostile moves. Fishing nets hung over the side, and bandy-legged men worked to haul catches aboard. Captain Stillian stood at the rail.
Where do you hail from?
A man in tight blue trousers and a long tunic of embroidered silk shouted back. Caton frowned and cocked her head.
Caton Nimitard!
It was almost understandable, but slid so that she could barely distinguish the breaks between words.
It was too much to hope that they spoke Marth.
I think that's a variant of Old Frisian.
Worth a try.
Caton only ever used Old Frisian to read scripture in its original form, and hardly ever spoke it. Caton took a moment to gather her thoughts, trying to marshal them into a semblance of order. The declension for this would be masculine interrogative case, which meant that she would have to use the appropriate suffix to the word land. Wrapping her mind around Frisian, Caton spoke in that tongue.
What land the you from?
The Setter Kingdom, and you?
His next words eluded her. Then came a phrase almost straight from scripture.
Sailing beyond the moon.
We from Marth.
You can understand him?
It was a relief to switch back to Marsketh.
Some, but we haven't said anything complicated yet.
Beyond the moon. Did they never sail past here?
Ask how far behind them the land is.
Caton nodded and painfully stitched the question together in her mind.
Land the how far?
5 days.
Caton reported this back to the captain. She looked past him to the part of their boat that the navigator inhabited.
May I hope that we are going to continue on?
That's what you are paying us for. ask them if they have any charts they want to trade.
What will we offer in exchange?
Show him a glow disc.
The city seemed to sparkle in the sunlight. Glass filled windows in the walls and even in the roofs of buildings. In some places, the walls seemed to be nothing more than thin pieces of metal existing solely to hold glass upright. The wealth on display staggered Caton, but the people in the port paid no heed to it. They walked past the docks on their business, paying no more attention than if they had passed simple stucco at home. Their ship, on the other hand, attracted notice. As the crew worked to tie it up, they used a mixture of sign language and grunts to communicate with the dock workers. Even the ships here had glass set into the cabins. Their own ship, the Maiden's Leap, seemed dark and squat next to the ships of Mond. The captain stood by her shoulder.
Is it a festival day?
Sorry.
Caton turned from studying the dock to face him. His frown had grown deeper the closer they had gotten to Mond, the city that the Seven Sisters must have departed.
The banners. Every ship is flying a red banner, sometimes two or three.
The captain nodded toward the crowds.
And see? People with armbands in the same red. What does it mean?
I don't know.
Now that he had pointed it out, the scraps of red were obvious, fluttering behind people as they walked. She had been so distracted by the variety of costume that she had not noticed that common thread. She pointed to a man with a blue armband who walked behind two burly men who appeared to be bodyguards, clearing a path.
Not everyone has the red band.
I thought this was supposed to be your homeland. Weren't you keen to come back so you could practice your religion freely? So you ought to know, even by the calendar, if this is a festival day.
It's not, but we've been gone so long. Perhaps they added festivals?
You sound uncertain.
And how am I supposed to be certain? I've not set foot upon the land.
Fair enough. Shall we remedy that now?
Caton nodded. The captain led the way to the gangplank, which stretched from their boat to the pier. At the foot of the ramp, the first mate was speaking heatedly to a man who blocked his path. The man wore a blue armband and, like the one they had seen before, had two enormous bodyguards. They each carried a short sword with a strange grip and a small sheath at the waist. Even the men obviously engaged to be fighters wore dark blue silk. Across their chests, little mirrors had been sewn into the fabric and flashed light with each breath. Tucking his hands behind his back, the captain stopped behind his mate.
What is the problem here?
Blamed if I know, sir. They won't let us off the ship, that's clear enough. But I can't make a sea-bound dog of anything the fellow is saying.
Caton wanted to retreat up the gangplank before the captain could turn to look at her. She did not speak the language, for all that he thought she did. She took a step backwards and stopped herself. It would do no good to hide, and likely she was the best chance for understanding what the blue gentleman wanted.
Perhaps I can help.
I would be grateful if you would try.
The captain turned sideways so she could slip past him on the gangplank. Caton marshaled the old Frisian in her mind.
I give you greetings.
The man stared at her and said something very rapid. She could not even tell where one word ended and the next began. His voice slipped like oil upon the water.
Speak slowly, please. I do not understand.
His lip curled, and he spoke slowly, mockingly, as though she were a damaged person. Still, she caught only a few words.
Name, travelers, Oxtail.
Did you say Oxtail?
Yes. Show me your oxtail.
Then his speech exploded into a confusion of words.
I am sorry. I do not understand.
Oh.
The man threw his hands up into the air in an obvious sign of aggravation. He turned to one of the bodyguards and gestured toward the ship imperiously. The meaning of the next two words would have been clear even if Caton hadn't finally been able to understand him.
Take it.
The bodyguard to his left stepped forward, unsheathing his sword. Except it was not a sword. It was a hollow tube which he pointed at the first mate, who still stood at the bottom of the gangplank.
Move.
The bodyguard gestured roughly, making his meaning clear. The captain put a hand on Caton's shoulder.
What is happening?
I...
Caton did not know. This was not what she had studied for. Caton turned to look over her shoulder at him.
They want something. He keeps asking for an oxtail. Maybe it's an offering of some sort. And now, I think, but I don't really understand it. It sounds like they want the ship, but I might be wrong.
The gangplank shifted as new weight stepped upon it.
I said you aren't coming aboard my ship!
Caton grabbed for the rough rope rail as the gangplank shuddered. She turned back in time to see the first mate shove the bodyguard back. The huge man looked astonished and angry. He pointed the tube at the first mate and then... Smoke billowed off the end of the tube. On the docks, people pushed away from the sound. The first mate took a step backwards and then sat heavily. The back of his jacket was staining red. He toppled to the side and fell into the water.
Listen!
The captain stared at the spot where his first mate floated face down in the water. Blood curled around him in the water.
I need a lifeline!
As a crewman ran to get rope, the captain pushed past Caton, never taking his eyes off the first mate. What had happened? She did not understand what had happened. The blue man on the dock said something, and it took Caton a moment to realize that he was speaking to her.
I do not understand.
No one move. Tell them.
Captain, he wants everyone to stay still.
No, I have a man down. Where's that rope?
A crewman ran to the edge and wrapped a coil around the rail. His fingers tightened a knot.
I said no one move.
A man drowns.
Caton pointed at the first mate. The water was so red.
Dead already.
The man in blue turned to the bodyguard.
Make it two.
Below her, the captain jerked and stumbled. He grabbed the rope railing with both hands.
No!
His feet went out from under him, and he dropped to his knees, still clutching the banister. Caton found herself behind him, pulling him back from the water as the acrid smoke curled around him. She wrapped her arms around him, feeling the blood soak into her tunic. Her scarf of office fell across his chest.
Stop! We do what you say!
Good.
The blue man's teeth glinted in the sun.
Good.
The square of sunlight in the prison wall sent a harsh beam across the wood floor. Caton could not think of it as anything other than a prison, for all that it had large windows overlooking a center courtyard. The guards made their status clear. The ship's crew was held in a dormitory, quarantined from the other prisoners. Caton sat by Captain Stillian's cot and dipped a cloth in the dish of water she had begged from Proctor Vella.
The guards tell me that we will have Titam and Kalkos this afternoon for lunch.
Stillian shifted on the cot.
Dare I ask what that means?
Titam are potatoes, and I think that Kalkos is lamb. At any rate, it seems to share a root with Kalka, which is the word for sheep. First should be a diminutive, so lamb, I think.
A man came every day to give them language lessons. Proctor Vella was patient to the point of seeming a machine, but she was the only one of the crew that made any effort. The others all muttered about escape, as though getting past the guards in their hollow tubes was a possibility.
Any luck finding out what our crime is?
Caton shook her head. In the fifth night since they had been taken, her grasp of Sidish had improved enough to almost understand why the others were being held. Almost. It was so clearly descended from the same roots as old Frisian that learning it had been easier for her than for shipmates. Still, she only almost understood. Or rather, she understood the words, shy of an oxtail, but the meaning eluded her.
When I ask what an oxtail is, Proctor Vella says that it is the tail of an ox.
Next time, I'll have one pickled.
Stillian closed his eyes.
So, lamb tonight, eh?
Yes.
Caton dipped her cloth in the water again and looked across the dormitory. Porritt, the navigator, stood in a tight cluster with three other crewmen. One of them seemed to be blatantly counting the number of times the guard walked past the door.
Proctor Vella says that they would normally provide a translator so we could answer for our crimes, but no one knows Marskuth, or Old Frisian for that matter.
Porritt broke away from the group and crossed to the captain's cot.
I can take over, if you like.
It was not an offer. Caton bit her lips and put the cloth back in the basin.
Of course.
She stood and strolled away, trying to linger long enough to hear what they were going to talk about.
Caden tells me that we're having lamb tonight.
Scowling, she squatted by one of the walls and smoothed her scarf of office. With her arms crossed, she took the ends of the scarf between her hands, symbolizing the path the Seven Sisters took through the heavens, and began rolling the beads between her fingers. Each sister had a separate role in guiding a person's behavior through life. Caden appealed to Zoe, the middle sister, to grant the captain resiliency. He must get well and do nothing foolish.
What are you doing?
Caden opened her eyes, ready to frown at the crewman who had disturbed her, before realizing that the question had been in Seedish. Proctor Vella stood in front of her. It was not his day to teach.
I am praying.
He frowned. Lines creased his face more deeply than they should have in one so young.
No, you are not.
What? Yes. Yes, I am praying.
Caden held up her scarf.
This is how we pray where I come from.
Or rather, it was how the followers of the Seven Sisters prayed.
I have studied all six of your provinces, and no one prays to the moon squatting.
It's not the position, it's the...
Caden bit her explanation off. If she drew attention to her scarf of office, they might take it from her.
Stand. The Apex Counselor has decided to hear what you have to say.
The council sat in a squat room, not at all grand, with a broad table in front of them. Yet even here, in the most utilitarian of chambers, great windows stood behind the counselor and cast light across his table. Stacks of paper crowded the surface in front of his aides, piled in neat right angles, every corner squared to the edge of the table. On either side of the door stood guards with tall spears. Tassels hung from the shafts, making the weapons look almost ornamental, but the light that gleamed from the edges made it clear that these were honed and sharp. Their breastplates were painted with a lacquered rendition of the moon, with silver rays blending into the metal of the armor. The velvet of their livery was a blue so deep as to be almost black. Tied around their upper arms were blue armbands which appeared light only in contrast. As Caden was brought into the room, the counselor shifted a pile of paper closer to himself.
You've been accused of being shy of an oxtail. How do you respond?
I do not know what an oxtail is.
Silhouetted by the window, his face was not visible, but the sharp jerk of his head was unmistakable.
Do not toy with me.
I am not. I have no understanding what you are speak of.
Every citizen must have an oxtail to travel outside their city of birth.
Perhaps that is the problem. I am not a citizen. We are from Marth, across the sea.
Even if there were something across the sea, there is no way to navigate outside the light of the eternal moon. The fine for being without your oxtail is not so egregious that you must make up fairy stories.
I am not! We have been trying to explain since we got here that we are explorers from the other side of the world. Where I come from, an oxtail belongs firmly on an ox.
Are you saying oxtail?
Yes, that is what the man at the ship asked us for.
You were supposed to have had language lessons.
I did.
From an historian. Your province speaks a particularly backward form of Cetian. Still, that might explain some of the confusion. You are saying oxtail, but what I mean is oxtail.
What is the difference?
One is the tail of an ox, the other is a license to travel.
She gaped at him. The first mate who had been shot.
One of my shipmates was killed because we couldn't understand what the man at the dock was saying.
All provinces have the same requirements. You should have undertaken this before leaving your home.
Caden lost her temper and felt the touch of Farah on her soul.
I told you we are from across the ocean. We could not possibly have gotten an oxtail before leaving because we didn't know that there was such a thing. If you tell us where to go get a license, I'm sure we'll all happily pay the fee.
One of the aides scribbled something on a piece of paper and passed it to the counselor. He studied it for a moment.
Why do you keep insisting on this fiction? Navigation is not possible out of the sight of the blessed moon.
We navigate by the stars. Really? Have you had no one else visit your shores?
Castaways from one of the darker islands. The stars move. How do you propose that one navigate by them?
Caton faltered. She knew nothing of the subject beyond seeing Porritt do it.
I am not certain.
Because it cannot be done.
No, because I am not a navigator. If you were to ask her, I am certain she could explain. I am here solely because I have some ability with your language.
And to what do you attribute that?
It is related to our holy language. I am a priest and required to be versed in it.
With her words, something in the room changed. The counselor became very still. By the door, one of the guards shifted his hands on his spear. The counselor leaned back in his chair slowly.
I will grant that you are not a native speaker of Seedish. That much of your story appears to be true. So it is possible that you mean something else by the word priest.
Caton reviewed what she had said and worried the inside of her lip. She had taken the word from Old Frisian, and it was possible that the meaning had shifted.
I mean a holy woman or man dedicated to the service of the Seven Sisters.
Who?
The Seven Sisters.
Caton raised a hand to her scarf of office and held the beaded ends out to him.
Our holy book says that they came from across the ocean, and we...
Are you saying that this is a religion?
The sweat on Caton's hands clung to the scarf, adding to the dirt from Fifth Night in the prison. She lowered it and wiped her palms on her leggings.
By my understanding of the word, yes. It is possible that the language has shifted.
Do you worship these Seven Sisters?
Yes.
So brazen. Ironic that the most damning piece of evidence against you is the one that convinces me your story is true.
I don't understand.
Every year, the Council of Purity finds someone misled by one old cult or another and takes steps to correct the poor soul. These misled fools have turned their back on the Eternal Moon, and, knowing that it is wrong, they try to hide their depravity. Yet here you stand, claiming allegiance to goddesses that no one has ever heard of, as though there would be no consequences.
They are not goddesses.
So you deny it now?
No! I merely wish to be clear. Goddesses are born that way, if one believes in such things. The Seven Sisters came from here and shared their wisdom with the early Frisian people. It is said that they were elevated to the stars to continue to watch over us and guide us.
You do not deny, though, that it is a religion?
I do not. You spoke of consequences. What are those?
The moon is eternal, and so we live by her light. Either accept that or accept the absence of her light.
Given that until a fifth night ago I had never seen the moon, I can easily accept the absence of her light.
Looking down, he made a mark upon the paper in front of him.
Place her in a cave.
A protest formed on her lips, but Caton bit it back. What could she say? She did not accept the eternal moon, not when she had good reason to know that it was not eternal. She kept her chin high as the guards came to flank her.
It occurs to me that we should speak to this navigator. If they do come from out of the sight of the moon, then we should find this land and bring them into the light.
Caton stumbled over the threshold as the guard thrust her into the cell. A torch flamed in his partner's hand, lighting the crude underground passage.
Enjoy the dark.
The closing of the door dropped the cell into twilight. Caton waited for the darkness to descend. Light trickled under the door and from a crack in the wall. It was not bright, but enough to make out the shape of the room. A small table with a chair stood by the wall, A cot stood opposite it. Her final piece of furnishing was a bucket to hold her waist. The cave was nothing more than a windowless room. Caton sank onto the bed and pulled the glow disc out of her sleeve pocket. She turned the disc over in her hands without opening it. There was nothing she needed to see, but having the smooth surface under her hands helped her think. Their ships ran dark. Windows everywhere. Crude torches. Had she seen a single artificial light besides the torch? No. With the light of the moon, they did not need anything except on cloudy nights, and perhaps they thought this was a dark room. On the small table, Caton had placed her glow disc facing the door. She held the bedsheet in one hand, waiting until she heard the footsteps of her guard with her daily meal. Shaking the disc until the light reached its brightest, she tried to keep her breath steady. A moment later, the small slot in the base of the door opened so the guard could pass her tray through.
Behold the moon! The eternal moon has come to visit!
Her glow disc could not overpower the torch, but its silver-blue light beat it back some.
What in heaven's name?
Caton let the sheet fall in front of the glow disc to diffuse the light and make the source seem larger than it was. She leapt across the small room and grabs the waste bucket by the door. The guard gawked at the glowing sheet and took a step into the cell. His torch guttered as he crossed the threshold. Caton upended her bucket of waste on the torch, covering the smoking end with the metal. Kate swung the bucket hard, catching him across the side of his head. Moving as quickly as she could, Caton began to strip the guard of his clothes. As she rolled him over, her hand brushed the sheath by his side. He wore one of the hollow tubes. Hesitating for only a moment, Caton unbuckled the belt that held the tube at his waist. It would surely be more useful than his uniform if she could figure out how to work the weapon. Caton kept her shoulders back and marched with as much authority as she could muster. She had needed to roll the cuffs of the guard uniform up, but it hid the worst of the staining, and in the shadows of the reflected moonlight she hoped it would pass, though for all she knew they had height restrictions on who could be a guard. She was in the building where her shipmates were held. The captain was not in good condition, but they needed to leave, and this was likely their only chance. Caton approached the guard slouching by the window. A window in the wall cast a beam of light across the corridor. Anyone approaching would be well visible then. The guard straightened upon seeing her and made a movement with his hand over his heart.
A salute?
Guessing, she hastily copied his movement, hoping he would buy it as a salute back.
What can I do for you?
The foreigners.
She had been thinking of this phrase the entire way here, so it would roll off her tongue as if she were a native Seedish speaker.
The Apex Counselor says they aren't worthy to see the light, supposed to take them to the caves.
Now, the moon will be full in less than half an hour. You won't get them there before prayer time.
Orders.
And by yourself? For 20 men?
Before the guard could finish enumerating the reasons that this made no sense, Caton had the end of the tube pressed against his forehead.
Is this clearer? Take me to the foreigners.
The guard held very still, which was fortunate, as she had no idea what to do with the weapon she held. Only the fact that one end was obviously a handle gave her even a hint of how to hold it. Reaching forward, she pulled his weapon from the sheath on his belt and tucked it into her own belt.
I could yell.
I could kill you.
Gunshot would call the other guards.
So the outcome for me is the same either way.
Caton pressed the tube against his head more firmly.
Stand.
The guard slowly rose and led her down the hall to where the members of her ship... No, to where her fellow countrymen were being held. Caton followed behind with the weapon trained on his back. When they reached the cell, she rested the tip on his spine.
Unlock the door.
The guard reached for his keys. They unclipped from his belt and fell to the ground. Caton scowled at him. That was clever. He had followed her instructions, but in such a way as it would force her to take the gun off his back to pick up the keys. And this was where the Seven Sisters' meditation exercises came in handy. Caton kept the weapon against his back as she reached forward with one foot. Sliding the keys toward her, she was able to scoop them off the floor with the toe of her boot, as if she were practicing Doro's stance. With her free hand, Caton gave them back. Caton gave him a shove forward. In the cell, the crew of her ship sat up, blinking in their beds. Tempting as it was to look to the captain, Caton kept her gaze on the guard. She spoke in her native tongue.
Someone secure him, quietly.
Porritt stared at her in open disbelief for a moment, before yanking a rope made of torn sheets out of her cot's mattress.
Where did the rope come from?
In a matter of minutes, the guard was stripped of his uniform and trussed in makeshift rope with a wad of cloth shoved in his mouth for a gag. The other crewmen scrambled into their clothes, pulling on boots and shirts in disciplined silence. Now, Caton could take the time to look to Captain Stillian. He stood by his bed, pulling on the guard's uniform. That morning, he could barely sit, and now it was as if his health had never been in question. They had been planning an escape and had not told her. A knot of nausea twisted in her stomach. They had not trusted her because her people were from here. Clenching her jaw, Caton turned away from him and headed to the door. A moment later, Stillian was by her side. He leaned down to breathe in her ear.
I give thanks to the sisters that you are safe.
You've been pretending to be sicker than you are.
I kept hoping that they would take me out of the cell to a doctor, or bring a doctor here we could use as a hostage.
You didn't tell me.
It seems safer to pretend to everyone than to chance our captors guessing.
You were ready to leave without me.
We were ready to come find you. I wouldn't leave one of my crew behind.
Caton's nausea eased at his words. They were all fellow countrymen in this place. Caton handed the captain one of the weapons.
Thank you.
By the door, the navigator waved her hand, signaling that the hall was empty, and they headed out into the moon's cold light. With each turn, Caton expected them to be caught, but the shadows served them well. As the moon rose to its full height, the cold silver light flooded the streets and houses. They were exposed when crossing the streets, but tucked under the eaves in the shadows, they were nearly invisible. The wind carried hints of salt air, and the captain straightened his head. Even without a nautical background, Caton's own stride quickened at the scent. The sea would carry her home, all this time seeking her people's homeland, and she was fleeing it in the night. In front of them, Porritt held up her hand, signaling a stop. She beckoned Stillian and Caton closer.
We should send one ahead, in case they are waiting for us.
Likely they are. I'll go.
Don't be silly. You need to be aboard to get us home.
Mostly you need Porritt for that.
Captain Stillian eyed the end of the street where the harbor was just visible.
Besides, I can tell the state of the ship and you won't know what to look for.
It was sensible, though she still wished he would not go.
Both of us? As if we are patrolling?
Agreed. It will look more natural with the pair, I think.
Caton led the way before Stillian could change his mind. He caught up with her a moment later, and they strode down the street toward the harbor. The captain rested his hand upon the hilt of the tube weapon.
Do you know how to work this?
No idea.
Thank the sisters. No one has noticed our absence yet.
Ahead of them lay their ship, tied to the same dock they had first arrived at. Only a single guard stood at the foot of the gangplank. Better than merely standing, he had his face tilted up to face the moon in an attitude of prayer. Their arrival coincided with the midnight moon reaching its fullest brightness. Though Caton and Stillian were exposed walking down the street, the guard would be night-blind from staring at the bright orb overhead. Stillian turned briefly to wave Porritt forward. The crew responded instantly and hurried as one down the street to their ship. Caton quickened her own pace. When they hit the wood of the docks, the guard looked down from the moon. He blinked.
Alarm!
As his voice rose into the night, Caton recognized him. Not a guard at all, but Proctor Vella. Behind them, a half-dozen soldiers appeared on the dock, cutting off their retreat. Caton sprang forward and shoved the tube against the proctor's chest. Her bluff had worked once. Perhaps it would again. In Seetish, she shouted,
Stop or the proctor is a dead man!
The soldiers slowed at the end of the pier, their weapons raised to point at the sailors. There were far more sailors than soldiers, but every single one of the guards had one of those cursed tubes. The proctor looked past her to the sailors and appeared to be counting their number.
I confess surprise. I had not thought to check the prison after your escape from the caves.
Tell your soldiers to leave.
No. You may shoot me if you like, but you shall not escape judgment under the blessed light.
Proctor Vella looked down his nose at Caton.
As long as we escape here, I'm fine taking my chance on judgment.
Even if I stepped aside and let you aboard, what then? You are advocating a heresy, and the Apex Council will find you no matter where in the kingdom you go.
We're from across the sea.
The image of the moon sinking below the horizon gave her an idea.
If your ship follows us, our seven sisters will drown the moon.
You think we do not know that our world is round? The moon does not drown if one goes too far west. She remains over the capital to provide her blessings upon our people. No life exists outside of her divine sight.
Caton did not bother giving him an answer. She looked to the captain and switched back to her native language.
Ideas on what to do?
This?
Dillian pointed his weapon at the guards. The guards scattered, ducking behind barrel and poles, but none of them fell. This unleashed the sailors to fall upon the guards. Caton pushed the proctor hard in the chest and he stumbled back. His heel went out past the edge of the dock and he tumbled over.
Move! Move!
Like wharf rats, the sailors obeyed their captain. Porrick was the first past Caton, hauling a wounded sailor over her shoulders. The others followed, leaving behind the bodies of the guards, but not their fellow shipmates. They all boarded the ship.
Cast off!
Caton retreated to the rail, attempting to serve some purpose by watching for pursuit as they pulled away from the dock. Her last image of the city was of Proctor Vela splashing in the water at the base of the dock. The blessed light of the moon shone upon him. They sailed due east under full sails for hours. Porrett told the captain to take the course that would put the most distance between them and the land, and she would get them home from there. Caton stood with her hands tucked under her arms. Between her fingers, she rolled the barrel of the weapon as if it were a prayer bead, begging each of the sisters for aid in their escape. The prayer was automatic, but the belief did not follow. Caton had been to her homeland and discovered that it was not the thing of legends. There was no safe place for her people, not here. The captain came to join her at the rail, still in his borrowed uniform. He sank down on a coil of rope.
Are you all right?
I may have lied a little about faking my illness.
She went back to watching the path behind them.
Thinking about your sister's birthplace?
Caton rolled the barrel another turn.
The Apex Counselor said that they would send ships after us.
You mean the fellow at the dock? Even if they got a crew up and running as soon as he was out of the water, we've got a significant head start on them.
I don't mean just us. I mean Marth. I think they're going to invade.
Caton held up the gun.
I keep thinking that our country will need to work to catch up with their weapons.
He stared up at the sky.
Huh. I guess the Seven Sisters may have led us here to give us a warning.
That's the third time you've spoken of the Sisters tonight. You don't have to act like you believe in them.
To my surprise, I'm not. I'm not pretending, I mean.
The captain pointed at the cluster of stars in the sky.
You told me that every story has some truth behind it. Finding the truth here makes me trust the parts I haven't seen the truth of yet.
Caton followed his gaze up to where the sisters traveled their path across the heavens. Maybe the truth was that the Seven Sisters had fled their homeland. Or maybe they had been blown off course. Or perhaps they were guardians who looked over her people, and the light of Monde lay behind them, casting silver across the sea. The moon threw its silver light in a band across the sea then, chasing her home.